one morning, we had just all been rudely awoken from our dreams, and we were all standing too bleary-eyed, and all of a sudden we heard such a weird noise coming up from the depths of the ground. There were some squeaky bugles, some whistles, and to top it all, there was all brilliantly coloured lights floating around all over the place. I thought I was back at the fairground somewhere. We could actually hear some people scrambling around on the hill. There was no sort of quietness about it. They just come marching up the hill, unafraid of anything, blowing their bugles, and the officers, I presume, blowing whistles and directing operations right from in amongst the ranks, shouting out orders, and we could actually hear them shouting, talking, joking and laughing. And they come right up until we actually did open fire, and then all hell let loose.
Chinese attacks were not supported by artillery, but by a reasonably high volume of mortar fire, ranging in caliber from 60 millimetre to 100 millimetre. Much fire, automatic fire and small arms fire was used. I must say, I always thought it was to their credit that they were without very much artillery and, of course, little or no air support.
Well, I'd say that the China soldier was a pretty well-trained man. He was quite accurate with his mortars. He could lay down pretty good effective fire from his machine guns. When he's attacking or anything like that, the individual skill of each man was very good as regards his field craft. They could hide themselves pretty well, and they seemed pretty well disciplined.
During the afternoon, our observation posts noted a good deal of movement coming down from the north, little bodies of figures, which we made out to be soldiers of some sort, as they were all wearing uniform clothing, but we couldn't be sure whether it was North Koreans or Chinese. Anyway, on that evidence, our commanding officer, Colonel Khan, decided that the river crossing should be covered by a patrol that night, and indeed a fighting patrol under Lieutenant Temple went down to cover the crossing. I think the most we'd expected to cross was a company or two, and thus he was very surprised when the first file of figures that entered the water and tried to come across was shot up and repelled, was succeeded by at least a company size and their soldiers trying to get across. The patrol stayed down there as long as they had ammunition, and they then hurled a few and under orders from Colonel Khan withdrew. It was at this time that Lieutenant Phil Curtis, who was a platoon commander in A Company, the left forward company, took part in an action in which he won, posthumously, the VC. In order to get the troops out, it was essential that a machine gun post on a piece of dominating ground in A Company's position was knocked out. Leading a small body of men, they made their way forward onto this high ground, but were forced back by very heavy fire. Curtis himself was wounded. He got up, went forward to the wire, again was wounded, and was taken back by the men with him. He then got up by himself, badly wounded, and ran forward and kept running until he was within grenade range, when he threw a grenade which actually knocked out the machine gun post, but before the grenade landed, the post itself killed him.
During the actual battle, while we were in a very strong position, the battalion was holding the right of the line. We didn't have any difficulty at all in shooting the Chinese off. They attacked continuously over 3 days and three nights, and it was, to a large extent, money for old rope. The only bad moment I had during the battle was when the Chinese set fire to the ridge my company was holding. Luckily, it happened before dark, and we were able to get the fire out and re-establish ourselves before the main attacks came in. We managed to stockpile a certain amount of 3.5 rocket launcher, bazooka-type weapons, and when they went in to attack one of our neighboring companies, we were able to let them have quite a large amount of high explosive, not primarily intended for ground troops, at about 100 yards range. The effect on the Chinki morale was, to put it mildly, pretty devastating.
If I could say what was probably one of the worst moments of my life, certainly the worst in this particular campaign, I would say that it was the time when I had to get on the blur, on the wireless to the Gloucesters, and speak to their adjutant and tell them that they had to stay where they were, that attempts had been made to relieve them, but that the orders were they would stay. I always remember the way they took it, without a word, without a query, and just in the way that you expect an infantry battalion of the line to take it.
On the morning of the 25th, we were being attacked very heavily, one wave after another, and I remember very clearly the adjutant shouting down into the valley to Drum Major Buss to sound some calls. The drum major was very pleased of the opportunity to blow his bugle. The adjutant's reason for doing this was because the Chinese were blowing bugles all the time. It was for their attacks, and we were getting a bit tired of listening to bugles, so we thought we would have one back on them. Well, the drum major went through, I think, all the calls in the book, and it was very stirring when he blew Reveille to hear all the battalion give a rousing cheer.
When our thoughts go back to the darkest and gravest days of this historic United Nations venture, to the enemy's spring offensive of 1951, the Gloucester Battle of last April stands forth in bold outline. It was an unforgettable action, executed in the best traditions of sheer doggedness and personal courage. The blackened hills and rocks of Gloucester Valley in Korea are silent these days, many miles behind our lines. They look very different from the green fields and hedges of the county with which this far-away place in Korea is forever linked. Yet that lonely dark valley will be eternally illuminated by the memory of how the Gloucesters stood and fought there against the human wave from the north. There is no need for me to recount the detailed story of that battle. It is well known in Gloucestershire, in England, indeed everywhere in the free world. The memory of it is more than just one additional battle honor added to the history of a famous regiment. The bravery of the Gloucesters has demonstrated to a world plagued with the conflicts and tensions in which we live today, the power of collective security, a power recruited on farms, in villages, in an ancient cathedral city.
We started hand-to-hand fighting, bayonets, rifle butts, give them everything we could, and, they were all over us. There was just thousands of them. Sometimes we couldn't distinguish between those and our own blokes. Well, we drove them off a couple of times, and then we started losing the NCOs. So I got what was left of the boys that could move, and organized a party, and we collected all the grenades we could find. And we just went up the hill about 10 times, I think, and just let them have it with these grenades. The young medical orderly, he got hit in the throat with a piece of shrapnel. That just about put the lid on it to me. I just got up and said, well, they sort of can't get away with this sort of thing. So I led a charge to the top of the hill just to clear it while the rest of the company could get organized to withdraw. And we started using these beer bottles and stones and anything we could lay our hands on. And then I sort of passed out a couple of times. And then the sergeant major sort of picked me up and helped carry me down the hill.
There were two main columns which were marched back over a period of 2 to 3 weeks, right up to the north. Quite a number of men were wounded, and the more heavily wounded were dropped off on the way for the most part. Some died, some recovered.
We used to take the bandages off, and the smell was terrible. And finally, we linked up with the Americans at Ponyang Camp. The Yanks had already called it, the bean camp, because that's all they got, was bean balls once a day. And they were getting strafed there by their own planes, because they thought, and which was right, the Chinese were bringing supplies through the camp. We started from that camp to march to number one POW camp, and there was 700 of us in it. Every day and every night, there was men dying. By the time we got to the camp, there was 300 odd of us left. And out of that 300, there was over 100 went to what the Yanks called Boot Hill. Boot Hill was a cemetery. And the ground was so hard that you couldn't dig down. I've buried men there less than 3 foot under the clay.
They strung me up in one of the rooms with a rope around my wrist, my hands behind my back, and strung me to the ceiling, and then they tied my leg up behind my back and the rope around my neck, so that if I lowered my leg, I'd strangle myself. They left me there for quite some time, and then they released me down, brought me down and just left me in the handcuffs.
At 6:30 in the morning, the squawk boxes, high up in the trees bordering the camp, blared out Chinese and Soviet revolutionary music, beginning with a rich tenor rendering of "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth." You can imagine how relevant that seemed on 2 rice meals per day and boiled water. We didn't exactly clap our chopped hands and throw up our sweaty nightcaps. No, we staggered out from our fetid sleeping mats and lined up in the frosty morning twilight for Chinese roll call, followed by some pretty unenthusiastic physical jerks. After that, indoors to our icy squad rooms in the long Korean schoolhouse to join the queue for the washpan. Our rice and potato breakfast was at 8:30. At 10:30, the warning bell summoned us all to the bare, freezing camp lecture room, where the Chinese political commissar gave us, in his stilted English, our daily dose of communist indoctrination. We crouched before him on the bare floorboards until 12:30, and this was repeated from 2:30 till 4:30 in the afternoon. Then came the second and last meal of the day, menus for breakfast. After evening roll call, there was compulsory study of communist literature and group discussion. We made this farcical, but the windowless jail on the road awaited those who expressed too blatantly a hostile attitude. By 8:00, we lay huddled together in the darkness, each wrapped in his Chinese blanket and what clothing and rags he could muster against the terrible cold.
I believe that we must try to limit the war to Korea for these vital reasons: to make sure that the precious lives of our fighting men are not wasted, to see that the security of our country and the free world is not needlessly jeopardized, and to prevent a third world war. A number of events have made it evident that General MacArthur did not agree with that policy. I have therefore considered it essential to relieve General MacArthur so that there would be no doubt or confusion as to the real purpose and aim of our policy. It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual.
The communist threat is a global one. Its successful advance in one sector threatens the destruction of every other sector. You cannot appease or otherwise surrender to communism in Asia without simultaneously undermining our efforts to halt its advance in Europe. Once war is forced upon us, there is no other alternative than to apply every available means to bring it to a swift end. War's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision. In war, there is no substitute for victory. When I joined the army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
During the last year of the war in Korea, there was, of course, constant talk about an armistice. And as a result, you might have thought that the fighting would have slackened a bit. But oddly enough, in the last few months, some of the bitterest fighting took place of the whole campaign. Take, for instance, the battles of the Hook. The Hook was one of our battalion defensive positions, and it was possibly the most vital one of the whole of the Allied line, because it overlooked a lot of our own lines and also a lot of the US Marines on our left flank. And the Chinese, of course, realized how vital this position was as well. They went absolutely mad, and I've never seen such fanatical attacking. Somehow, firstly the Black Watch and then the Duke of Wellington's regiment stood up to this extraordinary attack and then ultimately threw the enemy back again through a combination of military skill and simple, unadorned courage. And I think it was those two qualities that earmarked the whole of the Commonwealth Division.
When we sit here tonight in our evening clothes, partaking of food off a white tablecloth, and enjoying ourselves in other ways, bear in mind that there are men fighting and dying in an endeavor to reach that peace for which we've been striving since World War ceased. In order to accomplish that purpose, you must quit your bickering here at home. You must quit playing petty politics. You must remember that there are certain things that have to be done here at home if we're going to accomplish this purpose in the world. We're fighting for time. The young men in Korea and Japan are fighting for time for us. There's always an emphasis on the casualties in Korea. Of course, when there's fighting, there are casualties. But did it ever occur to you that if this necessity with which we are faced is not met, that the casualties in Korea will be one small drop in a bucket? One of those horrible bombs of which we talk so much. Think what a responsibility your president faces in a situation of this kind. If you'd think and think clearly on this subject, you'd get behind him and help him to win this peace, and that's what I'm asking you to do, and that's what our armed services in Korea wants you to do. I hope every one of you will go home, get down on your knees and pray for guidance to do the right thing, that these young men that are now fighting on the battlefields of Korea shall not die in vain.
This is the United Nations. The United States Ambassador, Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., has just arrived with the official truce communication, which he will present to Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld, Secretary General of the United Nations. Mr. Lodge.
Your Excellency, I have a note for you, which I shall read and then hand to you. Excellency, I have the honor to inform you that an armistice agreement has been entered into between the United Nations Command and the commanders of the Communist forces in Korea, that is, the Korean People's Army and the Chinese People's Volunteers. The agreement was signed for the United Nations command at 1000 hours on July 27th, 1953, Korean time, and becomes effective at 2200 hours, July 27th, 1953, Korean time. A report of the Unified Command transmitting the official text of the armistice agreement will be sent to you shortly. Accept, Excellency, the renewed assurances of my highest consideration. Let us thank God and fervently pray that this armistice heralds a lasting peace.
At last came the armistice. And this was signed in a wooden hut in a small village called Panmunjom in the middle of no man's land. The ceremony took place in almost complete silence, and the faces of our officials were as impassive as those of the Chinese and the North Koreans. There wasn't a gleam of animation throughout the proceedings, and I know that I myself came away from it thinking the whole thing had been a sort of dream. However, I realized it wasn't a dream, and it was reality that night at 10 o'clock when suddenly all noise on the battlefield stopped and there was complete and utter silence.
I think the Chinese went, according to what way the peace talks went at Kaesong. If the peace talks went all right, well, we got better food. But once the peace talks went anywhere bad, they cut down our rations again. And they always blamed it on the Americans for walking out. But anyway, in the wind-up, they gave us some peace wine. And peace wine, it was more like methylated spirits. Anyway, the boys couldn't drink it, but myself, I gathered up as many bottles as I could get, and I boiled it amongst water and a bit of sugar we got, and I made up a cocktail of my own. We drank that, and if Geordie, the man that fell in the lavatory, is listening, he'll remember my peace wine.
Tonight we greet, with prayers of thanksgiving, the official news that an armistice was signed almost an hour ago in Korea. And so at long last, the carnage of war is to cease, and the negotiations of the conference table is to begin. We have won an armistice on a single battleground, not peace in the world.
Personally, I do feel that there probably never was a war like this one, small as it may be, for bitterness and savagery. Not only because I hate to see dear old refugee gentlemen with bundles being knocked off with a bullet in the neck, not just because I hate to see dear old refugee gentlemen reaching into their bundles and fetching out a handful of grenades, not just because it turns the stomach to see commonplace little villages blasted and burned to ashes because they happen to be in the way of the advance, nor just because it's upsetting to see a hostile mortar team advancing behind the screen of old ladies and children. The worst thing of all for me is to realize, as you must do sooner or later, that all the rules have had to be abandoned. That once we were driven into this thing, it must run its course through every possible aspect of human degradation, and nothing will save those who get in the way of the machine. Neither age, nor youth, nor a paid-up party card, nor a ticket from MacArthur himself. Korea is terribly smashed now. But there'll be plenty of little people left who'll have neither the strength nor the means to work out their own salvation. It was an enormous decision, and it had, in honor, to be made. What happens now is in the hands of the people who live in Tokyo, and Lake Success, and Moscow. It's the first time they have had to cope with just this sort of a problem. I have a feeling that on how they handle it depends not just the future of poor old Kim Chong-long of Korea, but yours and mine.